Hello and welcome to Securities, an audio and video podcast, plus a newsletter focused on science, technology, finance, and the human condition. I'm your host, Danny Crichton, and today we're talking about artificial life, or a life. Artificial life encompasses a wide spectrum of computational approaches to life, consciousness, and sentience, and we'll scope it more and talk about where the frontiers of research are in today's episode. Joining me today, we have Luxa scientist in residence, Sam Arbsman, as well as special guest, Olaf Witkowski. Olaf has an extensive biography, one of those you really have to wonder if there wasn't like a medley of six artificial life forms all rolled into one person. But most notably for our purposes, he is the director of research at Cross Labs, an AI research institute in Kyoto, where he leads fundamental research in artificial life and ethical AI. And he's also the current president of the International Society for Artificial Life. Olaf, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So Olaf, let's start with you. I'd love to just get a general sense of the idea of artificial life. What is it, and how does it differ from the much more commonly discussed artificial intelligence?
Well, the way I see it is that artificial life is larger than artificial intelligence. I guess you could say that a reasonable definition is that it's life as it could be, as opposed to life as we know it. And it englobes different, diverse forms of intelligences that are possible in the universe and that we can possibly build from scratch by understanding their fundamental mechanisms.
And what's interesting in this field today, so when you look at, life as it could be, you know, I think of like exobiology, I think of life in outer space, I think of life on computers, I think of that episode of Star Trek, The Next Generation, where there are two-dimensional life forms and they're scanning it at the wrong edge and so they can't see it. That was probably like season five or something like that. But obviously, like life as it could be is such an open-ended, open concept problem. How do you sort of break up that sort of research field into different areas?
Yeah, I guess it did that naturally. The questions emerged by trying out. Mostly, it's a community of builders. So all the scientists are working on their own models. They're building them with different pieces. Mostly right now it's software, but we also use some wetware, right? Chemistry and also hardware, electronics, but also weird materials that you never heard about. It's just about replicating the properties that we see out there in living systems and trying to bring that inside within models that we can poke at and understand better how they work.
And Sam, you've been involved in artificial life, and I feel like everything, you're interested in everything. But one of your interests has been artificial life. So I'm curious, how did you sort of fall into this category? How did you start learning about it, and what interests you today in the field?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I mean, I think I got into it. I was very interested in like the origins of life, and kind of like and when it comes to the origins of life, the question becomes, okay, how do you move from like chemistry to biology? And then what does it actually mean to go from chemistry to biology? What is special about biology? And then alongside that, I've just been very interested in about the ideas of evolutionary biology, but then also kind of taking the algorithm of evolution, which is kind of this like process of natural selection across a population, and embodying it within a computer, within software. So that's kind of the things I've been very interested in. So of course, I mean, since people started using genetic algorithms or genetic programming, we've made great advances in this idea of like evolutionary computation. Like at this point now, and it's a very powerful optimization technique, I mean, which is essentially what evolution is. It's like, it's this process of like finding solutions to problems. In this case, in real evolution, it's like finding a solution to, okay, how can we get this species to be kind of the best fit or kind of reproduce the best. And I'm probably anthropomorphizing evolution a little bit, but kind of like how to think about that. In terms of like the different things right now, I would say one thing that is really exciting to me within the field of artificial life right now is this system called Lenya or Linea. And the idea behind it is it's actually like a modification or kind of like a fancier version of John Horton Conway's Game of Life, which kind of was, I guess, in like the 60s or 70s, which is this cellular automaton, this idea of like, okay, you have like a grid of squares, like they can be on or off, and they change from one time step to the next according to certain rules. And it turns out with the very simple set of rules, you end up getting these really, like, the really complex patterns that kind of emerge from these just the simple rules. And so, and people have been playing with this, and there's lots of interesting things there. And then more recently, Lenya is saying, okay, let's make it smooth. Let's kind of make it like continuous time, continuous space. And it turns out if you do that, you end up being able to create, like, there are these, I guess, like, organisms and species that kind of pop out from the rules and the pattern. And Olaf, am I describing Lenya properly? There's a lot of really interesting features of it. And so Bert Chan, he's the one who kind of developed this. But yeah, I think he found like over 100 different kind of persistent pattern organisms, essentially, in Lenya.
Yeah, we can definitely show those on the podcast or mention some videos. Those are very pretty to look at. It's really beautiful what from very simple rules what can emerge. And really, like you said, Sam, this came from very early on, maybe as far as John von Neumann's first self-replicating machines, right? His cellular automata, very simple creatures. Emerging from a very simple, modest computer. But now that we have all the... There were many evolutions based off that, and now we have something that is much more complex. I would say that the first phase of any of those simulation is that you start having something that maintains itself, a pattern that self-corrects, self-repairs through time, right? So it maintains a sort of identity as you watch it evolve. And then, yeah, the next step is really the evolution of it. So they can, some patterns can be selected for, and that's super interesting. So you can have all the evolutionary dynamics that we still study until now, and there are new things we can discover with that. And yeah, this is not the only one. There are so many forms of artificial living systems now. I guess Carl Sims was those kind of embodied robotics early on in the mid-90s. And you have Tierra that are much more like those cellular automata, but replicators that are trying to invade your PC, basically, right? That's also mid-90s or late-90s. With Tom Ray's Tierra, you have Avida, is a very similar idea by Charles and Chris and others at Michigan. So many of those things. Yeah, just it's amazing that those organisms can like a bit like viruses maintain themselves, just take advantage of the resource that are in there to maintain their own patterns. But then they start evolving, and that's purely amazing what they can achieve.
So when we think about cellular automata, so I think of, you know, Conway's Game of Life. You know, he does use the term life, you know, and this is for those who aren't familiar with it, is a very simple rules-based where if there's sort of a, oh God, now I'm going to just trap myself in having to explain cellular automata.
So I think the cell remains alive, I think, if it has two or three neighbors, and if, or maybe three or four neighbors. If it has less than that, it dies. And if it has more, or if it has a specific number, then it like,
right,
or in it, and it's not alive, then it becomes alive, and if it's like too high, too dense, it also dies. That's a very hand wavy, but like approximate description. Of it, yeah.
Exactly. So if you think of a square and a 9x9, the square in the middle is sort of the cell, and I recall it's sort of 2^8 power, right? So you have 8 cells nearby, and there's just different rules based on which of the cells have to be on and off, and there's a lot of delightful patterns that come out of that. Now, the question I have is, when we think about artificial life, does that meet the bar? Right, like when we define precisely, like what's the minimum life form, if you will, in the artificial sense? Like, does Conway's cellular automata, does that count as artificial life in sort of the modern way we approach the field?
Yeah, it's a very tricky question. I think the language is there is confusing too, right? Because it's game of life, and actually those cells are just on and off, and life is not there yet when they're on or off, right? But we call them alive, so it's causing extra confusion there. But yeah, so those can turn on and off, and then you can have amazing things that can appear that are patterns that are maintaining themselves and propelling themselves through the things. And those are called gliders. And you have whole families and classes of species like that can do amazing things. But just propelling yourself and changing yourself slightly through different states, where they cycle through states, that's already amazing. They sort of sense their behavior, their environment, and through their own behavior, right? And yeah, like you said, that there's a circle around them that they sort of their sensorium that they can they're able to perceive and can react to, and even more complex creatures like that have a problem. If they encounter anything weird, they're going to disappear. They explode. They can't maintain themselves beyond some kind of level of error correction, right? If the error is too big, they can't correct it and they just die off. I can't correct for this. It's much like humans, but those are very primitive. It's just about maintaining the pattern. They evolve into is they start making small memories. They start maintaining more and more memory about their environment. They can model at some point, if there is enough memory and they have the mechanisms that go with it, they can model their environments and react, predict the environment, which is much of what we humans do, right? We try to have laws of physics and science in order to predict better our environments and react to it and do amazing things. And that's what we see appears in those very simplistic models, and that's really exciting.
You know, when I walked in here, I was thinking like cyborgs and like artificial life in this way. But I what I'm getting at is more of like a Turing machine, which is like you're starting to think about actual primitives and very definitional, foundational objects that allow you to define life and non-life very tightly. So in to pull out a couple of pieces that you just said, memory or sense of self. So even though these are little dots that are literally scanning, I mean, in Conway's, you're calling them gliders, but in Conway's Game of Life, there are certain rules that allow sort of this object to move across the screen. And in that case, there's sort of the sense of identity, there's a sense of being. And even though it's just a couple of bits, we're starting to get a very small lens into what is the most primitive life form you could possibly have. Obviously, there's more and more. But from my perspective, I think what's interesting here is you have the sense of memory, the sense of genetic or evolution. So their sense of like, here is my identity and it can change over time. And then you call it a sensorium, but this idea of understanding I'm in an environment, a context, and that influences my outcomes. Do we cover the main kind of facets of artificial life, like memory, some sort of genetic evolution aspect, some sort of sensorium or environmental component? What else is there that would like be a primitive for artificial life? Are we missing anything?
Well, I guess there is the next steps that the creature can go into that is very exciting. Real quick, this could be learning and different ways of learning about your environment, right? And the exciting thing is that you didn't encode anything. All of this creature is just you keep it like you keep a cup of tea. You just watch it, and at some point, something becomes intelligent inside. How exciting is that? And it can become so intelligent, can model the world and do the same things as we do. And essentially what happened through evolution, we were studying really this pattern of learning and learning to learn, and possibly patterns that will be keeping, that keep learning forever. And it's not very easy to program. So the best computer scientists, best algorithms nowadays, stop learning at some point, right? They keep improving, but at some point they plateau and they become boring. They achieve their objective function and now they're not creating anything new. This creativity is something that is very central in artificial life and has real potential compared to other types of avenues. I would say that is super exciting.
And I think that also distinguishes between, like, I was talking about, like, I mentioned, like, evolution as this kind of optimization algorithm, and it is that, but, like, you're also speaking about evolution as sort of this, like the raw materials for open-endedness. And I think that like that open-endedness is like a very, very interesting aspect of artificial life. And this is also like one of these, like one of the current fields and the current avenues of research that people are spending a lot of time with.
Absolutely.
Now, Olaf, I mean, I jumped so far ahead, but so we sort of have an understanding of artificial life, some of these fundamentals, the building blocks. How did you get into this field before we jump into all the complexities of the modern world? What drew you into it? How did you stumble upon it? Like, this isn't the kind of thing that I went to middle school and they teach an artificial life class. And
yeah, it is not, and it should be. Maybe we'll talk about that. But I really want to create a tool of AI life, and It would have been so fun as a kid if I could have played with those models. I would have had eternal fun just learning new patterns and trying out new things. And there's so much you can do with just this very simple kind of simulation, right? It's just code. Kids can play with that and achieve amazing things. But the way I guess I got in there was... I guess I'm super excited by language or languages. I learned a lot of languages as a kid. It was my main hobby. And then I guess I was so excited about how come we have those languages are so complex, right? And how did that happen? I tried to program my own, right? There was ELIZA back then or other variants of that. You had one with MATLAB, you played with that, tried to code your own. But yeah, it was very difficult to achieve, right? Something that would be natural that you would have in the machine with rules, emerging from rules possibly, that you could treat as a friend and partner that would respond to you and you would learn from each other, right? So it sounds like, the kid that wants to build a friend. It's much, much like that. It made me a computer scientist. And I guess I just met people who were interested in the same questions about, nature of cognition, minds, science, ethics, and the artificial life community was a very exciting one when I met them. I guess I went through both routes. I went into academia, but at the same time I had a bunch of ventures that were doing this kind of science and machine learning kind of stuff research. But my main passion is this kind of universal. What are universal languages and what are invariants in language in any universe that you would simulate, right? What are alien languages? So what's universal about communication that would reoccur again if we went ahead and reran the tape of life again, right? So those kind of questions.
Mm-hmm. When you think about the community for artificial life, is it a space that's growing? Are there more and more people interested? Is it shrinking, growing, changing, evolving itself? Because in some ways, any community is sort of an organization, a sort of organizing of life in of itself. How's the community doing today before we jump into all the complex challenges today?
Maybe Sam can say what he thinks too, but I have this feeling that, so a bit like my name, Olaf, was very difficult for where I live for people to remember. All of a sudden, there was a movie that had a character recently for kids, right? And all of a sudden, everybody knows it's not exactly me, but yeah, it's easier to introduce myself. A bit like that.
That movie would be, I assume, Frozen.
Exactly. That's me. Letting it go. Very zen attitude. but I guess it's the same with AI that developed so much and has so much friction, congruence with artificial living systems, kind of concepts and theorems that now that language models are a thing, large language models, you can explain that to anyone, right? To elderly people, you can say, okay, yeah, it's like that, except, right? And you can start from that. So people are excited about AI, and now it gets easier to go into that. And in my view, artificial life is really this next step, or actually many diverse next steps for artificial intelligence. So that's my view of how it has evolved recently. Yeah, Sam, what do you think?
Oh, I certainly, there was early growth in like the 80s and 90s, and I feel like kind of parallel to the kind of AI boom and bust, there was kind of this period where it was not as hot and not as many people were kind of working on it. There were a number of people still kind of carrying the torch of A-Life, and it kind of continued. And then I do think, with kind of this resurgence of like generative AI and like more people getting excited about AI, they're beginning to think, okay, where can I go next with it? How do I think even more broadly about life? Not just like, I mean, intelligence is very important, very interesting, but like that's a subset of all the behaviors of life. And so I am hopeful that it will kind of continue growing. But it definitely has had kind of ups and downs similar to AI as well.
Yeah, I was just going to say there is so much interest I see in my students. Yeah, they're very excited about AI right now, and I see a growth in that with current advances rather than being interested in something else. It's I think it's growing very nicely.
Well, let's dive into 2023. I mean, so here we are. We're in the height of the AI craze. Lots of money, lots of people, lots of talent showing up. Think about generative AI and all these new technologies. First of all, what's sort of the differentiation between artificial intelligence and artificial life? You said sort of at the beginning, it's much more wide and wide angled. Is it also seeing kind of the surge right now? And what are the issues that people are worried about today in the artificial life community, both from the research side and the ethics side?
Right. The ethics side is a monster of its own. Very interesting. I think artificial life has real tools for that. In general, the difference between a life and AI, I really think it's larger, right? So AI, its goal is to model human intelligence. That's it, right? So you simulate human intelligence. That's the goal we have in AI. So I work a lot in AI, right? So we try to help the industry and society here. You can build tools, but what you're doing is really you're trying to take some stuff that humans can do really well, and you're trying to do that instead of them or help them and extend that, right? What you're trying to do with A-Life is in a way includes that, but it's really not only human. You look at diverse intelligences. That's the main thing we do. Diverse types of algorithms that can achieve similar properties, right? But also diverse media. So you wouldn't build it only with, it works really well with GPUs now. So you can use GPUs and Lenya DAWs, right? And other like swarm simulations that we do, like swarm intelligence of that uses that. But you don't have to. You can simulate it with artificial chemistry. You can simulate it with different substrates mixed, right? Hybrid systems, which is some of the research we do. How do you make those systems sort of collaborate? Different media. We're talking about, putting basically wood and water together and trying to make computation out of that instead of just one of them. And they both compute, right? It's a longer talk about that. But I think this hybridity and the diversity is really present. That's something we think about in unconventional ways in artificial life. And AI is into whatever works best right now, because you have to achieve, you have those standards, which is excellent. I like it, right? But you lose some of the heterogeneity of the discovery of computation, which we are more focused on. One addition that leads us to the ethical point, I think, is what you talked about before. You asked me about the sensorium, right? The Umwelt around the glider, right? Around this artificial agent, how they perceive reality. I think A-Life is interested because of its history also in cognitive science, neurophenomenology, study of subjective experience and so on, right? Studying the first golems what are the implications philosophically of those. We really study not only the creature, the artificial creature, from an objective point of view. So you are God looking at your creature that you created on your PC, right? But we also are interested in the subjective experience of being inside the simulation, in the cellular automaton, right? Like being within those running simulations and looking at the glider from the inside, or, which is the third point of view, being the glider, right? And you can actually study those concepts mathematically. It's not easy. It sounds easy when I explain it like this, maybe. But actually, we don't have a formal framing characterization of gliders. It seems easy. You can just point at it, but it's magical. You can point at it, but it's not characterizable in an easy way. It's so mathematically thrilling. I can't express enough like the excitement about this. Like you can point at the agent, but you can't mathematically write it down. How exciting is that? And I think this subjective perspective leads into What is it like to be this artificial being that you can create? And yeah, sure, the glider is a bit simplistic, but you can create fairly complex things. And I think artificial life gives you the tools to think about that very deeply. Because you have everything in front of you, right? You have all the ingredients. So it's now about thinking deeply, what is the math of the philosophy? What is it? The mapping between the math and the philosophy now.
I mean, Sam, you and I were on a recent episode of the podcast. And we were talking about Blindsight, science fiction book. And one of the things you corrected me on was this distinction between intelligence and consciousness, and specifically my sense of like emotion, that the fact that it emotes sort of indicates intelligence. And you were like, no, like that's actually our perception of intelligence. Like the fact that you feel like it's more likely to be intelligent just because of a certain action does not actually prove anything mathematically. And so when I think about this glider situation with some artificial life, I think of something very similar. Like here is this agent that's moving across the screen and moving through a space. I perceive it as intelligent because it seems to be moving around in the same way that the security camera in the office moves around, and it seems slightly intelligent. Someone's watching me in a panopticon. But the question I have is like, is that life? Like, is that just our giving it a name in the same way that Conway gave his game of life the name of life? Are we looking at this and going, God, there's something intelligent here. It's just happening on its own, this consciousness. Or is it the golem, as you were talking about? It's sort of it's an algorithm. It's running. It does things, creates unique fractal patterns. But we're seeing signal out of noise that doesn't really exist.
It's a good question. I think first of all, just to define life, like what is life? That is not a very far from a trivial task. Does it encompass like reproduction? Does it encompass metabolism? And I'm not even talking about like life as it could be. I'm talking about like, how do we distinguish between just like some weird chemical reaction and something like a cell? Like, what is the difference? And then of course, then you have all the edge cases of like, what's a virus? And so I think, and I agree with you that like we are, I think in the same way that we're predisposed to like notice faces and objects in clouds, or to think that something moving across a screen, it has intelligence. We notice things that kind of feel lifelike. And so I think we always have to be careful, like, not trying to like impute too much onto whatever we see. And so I think it's less about like, oh, this thing that I made is alive, and more about this system that I've developed can help me to understand and interrogate these following specific attributes that I think are important for life. And so, and going back, I think, because Olaf mentioned this earlier, like a lot of artificial life systems, like they're almost like toy models. They're saying, okay, let's take the messiness of life that we see and kind of like strip it down to, it's like to the bones and say, okay, here's the things that we care about. It might not be alive that we're creating, but it's going to kind of give us insight into what is life and how does life work and how does evolution work or whatever it is, or how does emergence occur. And so it's less about, and sometimes I think some people are actually trying to build life within a computer. And that's really interesting. But I would say many other times, and possibly even much more common, is about, okay, what are the features of life that I really want to understand? And then just trying to build a system to understand that. So it's less about like, okay, is this thing that I'm looking at, is it truly alive? Is it not? Like that's all, like that, that's, it's an interesting question, but it's often kind of like, it might be the wrong question when it comes to artificial life. Olaf, is that a reasonable way of thinking about this?
I think it makes perfect sense. It's such a difficult question to define life. So many people have tried that, right? I think Schrödinger's definition of self-assembly against nature's tendency to towards disorder or entropy, right?
He said that life would have like the genetic information would have to be part of some like aperiodic crystal, which basically he like predicted kind of like that there would be something like DNA, even though this was like before.
That's truly amazing. It's hard to grasp the genius of that crystal way before. That's right. There was the idea that preceded exactly right the concept, the computational concept. Preceded the discovery of the actual thing. And that's exactly what artificial life is attempting to do here. It's looking at properties instead of looking at, there were plenty of other definitions, right? So each NASA assembly, we have there's someone who is going to say something slightly different. Early on, Jay Joyce was all about the chemistry, right? Self-sustaining chemicals that are able to achieve evolutionary dynamics, right? Or something like that. And every time there is something, but then it's only chemistry. How about this other medium, and so on? So you might be looking at only von Neumann probes and all those maybe machinery or maybe different types of mechanics. I think when you look at that, it's better not to say living systems, or not to point at, it's okay to point at things and say it's life, but you want to really say start from the properties and see where you get. And that's what we do. So it's really bottom up kind of perspective, right? I might say something controversial here, but I think consciousness is the opposite. It's easier to define because everybody has one. I know everybody is alive, but we don't understand what that means. And experience, you have an experience. So at least you know where we start from. And if anything, science is intersubjective and starts from this experience. So that, as I said, this is controversial, but life, it's much harder. And so is intelligence in many ways. It's really broken down. There's no such thing as intelligence. It's really about the ability to do this, that, like different types of learning, representation, ability to achieve different types of symbols, self-reference, universals of communication. You know, we have to break that down to understand it. And that makes the most sense, yeah.
Well, if you're a philosopher of consciousness, please don't email me. Or if you do, we'll try to respond or something. I don't actually know. But so life is
very difficult.
I enjoy this. Exactly. This will be the one that has the most angry mails. But let's move on to some of the ethical issues, because I think you're getting at some of these philosophical challenges, some of these ethical issues. And certainly in the artificial life community, I think, you know, this has to have some of the most open-ended, challenging, almost black box and probably in some ways unanswerable questions around life and what is the meaning of this. And particularly if you have it on a computer, I think of something as basic as like, I just pulled a plug in the computer. Am I destroying all the life that is on it right now? Like what is happening? But what, when you think about 2023, what are some of the top two or three ethical challenges that the community of artificial life is sort of thinking about, wrestling with, et cetera?
I think it's as tricky as ever, but it's more visible now with the advent of the technologies we were just talking about before that seem very close. Now, I don't think they're as close as some people say, but definitely it's getting much more real, right? People can see how automation may happen in the next few years. And of course, yeah, you can replicate a lot of what we are as living systems or human systems. Like Sam said, I think it's very interesting that we tend to attribute qualities of life, qualities of even intelligence and definitely even consciousness for some, right? They're creating big debates to stuff that don't have them. And you know, I look at maybe a toy that, or maybe an imaginary friend, and maybe I can personify that entity very easily. We tend to do that, and we are a social species. It does make sense in many ways. Actually, part of the community studies that. So what are the tools that allow us to study that and talk about it? There are many traps in thinking about those things and their implications in terms of ethics. But I think it's also important that we, as we become hybrid beings, and I think, you know, with those things that we're holding in our hands every second of the day right now, we become augmented and we are hybrid beings. Maybe we transfer in a, much like some thought experiments, we replace some of our parts more and more by the prosthetics that correspond to them. And that's also something that A-Life is very interested in, because as you do that, you might have a change drastically in your embodiment, your Umwelt that we were talking about, the sensorium. And you might ask, what is the how are those things recognized? If I break someone's phone, am I breaking someone's body? Am I hurting them directly, right? It's maybe that relates to the sensation of pain. It's painful to break my phone. I feel the actual pain, right? And some of that may be real. There are illusions of agency. There are illusions of subjective various feelings that are very real. I feel them as real. And yet they are made from scratch. So what are the limitations of that? I think this is what we're exploring, I think, in the ethics of artificial life right now. And yeah, it's the extreme of that is ethics of robots, but we look at the whole spectrum, really, of hybrid living systems.
Let me I want to zoom in a little bit on this. So obviously there's a history of cybernetics that goes back decades, the 60s of sort of human augmentation that sort of turned into the cyberpunkian world of, I think, of like Neuromancer, William Gibson, et cetera. Lots of science fiction is built around either adding appendages or transforming, you know, uploading the human consciousness. When you get into artificial life, I mean, is it sort of all under the sun is sort of relevant here? Is it that certain categories, like you're talking about adding a part or, you know, if I slow off my body and replace it with a cloud-based installation and I become one with the algorithm, you know, is that still within the ken of artificial life?
I guess the center of artificial life is building entities that are autonomous from scratch and studying those properties. Now, what happens when you build something that attaches itself to something else, right? There is a big part of the community of artificial life, A-lifers, that actually concentrate on that. And it's everyone who studies cooperation, the emergence of cooperation, systems that communicate. And what we are looking at is really the emergence of symbiosis in those systems, and it's very simple. So when you have those little creatures, you know, in the simplest kind of simulations you can get, you'll have some pieces that might be eaten by other pieces, or will combine at some point and start helping each other. Maybe not at first, but in the end, the trees in which they evolve involve also some kind of loops, so they sort of merge back, and that's exactly what happened with real biological evolution. But here you can study it in the box, which is one of the big advantages of A-life. You can look at it and invent information theoretic measures, right? So some math that you can point at it, and or some glasses that you can put on to look at it, and could be different mathematical tools, but that allows you to see those mechanisms in another way. And one of them is cooperation. And it's such a big question, right? How come we care for each other? How come there is this emergence of being nice, basically, in nature or in those simulations that you see? What's the emergence of norms? You can simulate those effects. They're fairly complex within the box. I think that's a fabulous tool.
And let me ask you, when you think about, we're migrating from the individual artificial life, right? The individuality, the autonomy of an individual into, you call it civilizations, a social life, you know, connecting individual entities together. I'm curious both on sort of monoculture, so bring the exact same kind of entity into harmony with each other, so how they interact, and then different forms of artificial life, you know, different types of agents, different types of entities, and how they interact. Are we learning any lessons there in terms of from the A-life community, or is it mostly focused on kind of that individual agent?
No, as I said, I think there are a lot of people in A-life that do study. Swarms are the simplest ones. Early on, I guess it was mid late 80s, Craig Reynolds and then other people have encoded behaviors simply like they are called birdoids. The short version is boids. So they are little robots that fly in 3D And yeah, with very simple rules, actually three rules. They have cohesion, a sort of gravity. They also avoid each other a little bit, and then they try to align themselves with each other. Only three things, right? A bit like the game of Go is so simple and has a lot of emerging properties that are amazing. Same thing. Boys have so much interesting things happening. In those simple simulations. With those three rules, you manage to simulate swarms in amazing movies like Batman Returns, I think, and other things later on. They're very realistic, and also you can dynamically see how those patterns can maintain memories. How exciting is that? They don't have, none of those boards, those agents, right, flying around, have internal memories. And yet, they can remember things by combining their behaviors together into patterns that maintain something through time. How exciting is that? I think that's the first level of the simulation. But then you can add memory and all sorts of things happen, like they hold hands and do things together, or they forage together because they can share whatever they have to digest, enzymes and so on. You can simulate cells, you can simulate larger herds of animals, right? And that's, yeah, see how cooperation, also communication from signaling to a bit more complex language can occur within your simulation. And like you said, you can also simulate human societies, and people do exactly that. During the pandemic, a lot of simulations, multi-agent simulations, helped us predict very complex dynamics and what would be, for example, research at my lab trying to predict what's the best way to behave in terms of isolation, right? So how is it better to stay home for a week and then go out once, or is it better to distribute that? Like, so what's the right distribution of things, like bursts or things like that can be simulated. You can simulate best behaviors in society and so on. It's really fascinating, very powerful. Again, I don't know if there's some, if I'm, maybe there are many other examples.
I think Olaf might be the most excited person, except for Sam, on this podcast in terms of your enthusiasm for so many different parts of science. I want to finish up here because we're already covered a lot of ground. We've covered the definitions of artificial life. We've talked about some examples, some ethical issues, some of the piece about evolution and emergence of cooperation. Given how broad this subject is, how does someone join the community? How do people learn about this? Where do they connect to? Where do folks start? How do they get onboarded into this community today?
Well, it's pretty easy. So we are pretty present online these days. So you can join one of the sub communities very easily. You know, if you're into, say, Lenya, you can join one of those channels, or, you know, there are mailing lists. I would say look up the International Society for Artificial Life website. And then from there, you have a lot of links to a lot of things happening. And come to the conference. I think that's the best experience you can have. I know that students are super excited the first time they get to the conference. I definitely was. And you can see what many people are demonstrating. There are, you know, you'll see simulations, robots, even chemistry. And there are tutorials there. You can really, I think the most fun part of this is that you can very easily get your hands dirty and, you know, you have your laptop, you download the code immediately and start doing it with people around you and discuss about, oh, yeah, look, this pattern, I haven't seen it before. Have you seen this? How does that work? And you have all the specialists. It's a very tight community and they're very, very open to new ideas. I think it's super fun really to join those. And this year it's in Sapporo, just here in Japan. Exciting place to visit. So yeah, if you have nothing to do, it's actually next week. I know when you're doing this one. Yeah, join us.
Sapporo, the winter city of Japan, visiting in July. I have not been there, but it is a gorgeous place. But Olaf, we've covered a lot of ground. Sam, we've covered a lot of ground. So much more to talk about in A-Life. We have to have you back on the program at some point. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great.